This is Need to Know. Real talk about the reality of unidentified aerial phenomena. From Australia, Ross Coulthart. From the US, Bryce Zabel.
Hello and welcome to Need to Know. My name's Ross Coulthart from Down Under in a small town near Sydney, Australia. And in Los Angeles, my co-host and good buddy, Bryce Zabel. Bryce, you're just back from a holiday in Italy, I hear.
Well, my family had some friends who had a daughter getting married, and we used that as an opportunity to go to Sorrento, and I was brave enough to drive the Amalfi Coast, and I survived, so I'm feeling pretty good about that, feeling confident.
Did you see any retrieved flying saucers while you're over there? There's that great story about the Mussolini flying saucer that the Americans allegedly retrieved during the end of the Second World War.
Well, it's an interesting story. I mean, first of all, it illustrates that if you look into any particular country, you find all the UFO lore for it. So the Italian UFO lore includes that 1933 recovery, supposedly, of a crashed flying saucer. Mussolini was in power, and the guy he put in charge of looking into it was Marconi, the radio man. So it kind of an interesting story, whether it was recovered or not by the Americans after the war, I don't know. But I thought there was one other really interesting story that comes out of Italy. Apparently, 68 years ago this month, in October of 1954, there was a major soccer game being played, and a UFO, like a cigar, people described it like a Cuban cigar, came over the soccer stadium. All play stopped. There were 10,000 people in the stadium, and there's pictures from the time, and everyone's kind of looking up at the sky. And to this day, you know, people refer to that incident. It happened in Milan, and it was a demonstrably big deal. And then the other final piece of the Italian UFO puzzle is contemporary. We all know the Vatican is an independent country basically inside of Italy. There's another one called San Marino, a little country inside Italy that the United Nations is being petitioned to turn into the sort of home of the United Nations UFO UAP investigation. So that's my Italy report for now.
So while you've been swanning around the fine beaches of Sorrento and the Amalfi Coast, the rest of us have been doing some work, mate. And in the segments following, we've got quite dramatic revelations from the war in Ukraine. We have a former British soldier who is going to come on the program, and he's not talking about what it was that the Ukrainian astronomers saw. He's talking about what he and his colleagues saw in combat. During a battle, they looked up and they saw what they believe was something highly anomalous. More on that later. But I thought we'd just catch up with the week's news, because there's been a lot happening. And my favorite bit of news from the last few weeks, Bryce, is the logo that was pulled. The aviation manager, the national intelligence manager for aviation for the Office Defense, whatever it is, ODNI.
Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Yes. And very, very interestingly, one minute they put a logo up, a brand new logo, which has a flying saucer in it, a classic disc-shaped flying saucer. Everybody gets excited. The UFO community jumps up and down and says this is some sort of confirmation from an official intelligence agency in the Defense Department. And then just as mysteriously, it gets taken down. And we are meant to believe that this logo with the .mil URL was errantly posted, which I think is a flying ton of bullshit. I just don't believe it.
It sure sounds like it. I mean, here's the thing, though. This thing did happen while I was off running around Italy, as you pointed out, but it was up for a while, and it is a logo that it literally shows a part of North America and a part of South America, and you see three things flying over it. One of them, I believe, is a commercial jet. Another is a fighter jet. And then a third looks kind of like a triangle kind of craft, but literally out in left field over the ocean to the left is what looks like a UFO. It is a UFO. It's a classic UFO. And you know, their argument was, well, we put it out by accident. Honestly, I've had enough experience, and I'm sure you have too, where those kind of things are, something like that coming out by accident would be very rare. Now, on the other hand, we certainly know that logos over the years are often used and put some crazy stuff in them. And so you can't really say, well, that proves anything, other than it's kind of bogus. It just sounds bogus, and people reacted to it that way.
Now, Bryce, I think you're catching up by you're doing some work next week at the International UFO Congress. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. I just want to give a shout out to our friends over at the IUFOC, which they throw a yearly conference, and it's always been fantastic. I've spoken there several times, and they had to go into pandemic hiding for a couple of years. Last year, it was virtual. This is a time where people are coming back, and there's some really great people speaking at it. It goes from, I believe, October 12th through the 17th. And I'm speaking on October 15th, which is a Saturday. So I encourage anyone who's near Mesa, Arizona, who wants to come and talk a little need to know, to show up, and we'll do that. The topic of my speech is called Estimate of the Situation, something we've used before. And then the question is, will 2023 be sizzle or fizzle? And you and I have talked about that as well. And I'm going to, I guess, now I've set myself up for the standard. I have to take a position on it. So I'll be doing that.
So what are you going to say? Are you going to say fizzle or sizzle?
Well, I think maybe we disagree on this. I think there are sufficient things in motion right now that I look at it as a sizzle. I think we're going to have a sizzle. I just think there's too much going on. But I've got some, nuance to that. Now, I know you think 2023 is going to be a very big year, but at the same time, you're taking the position you think it might just fizzle out. So how do you square that circle?
Okay, let me explain. What I'm hearing is there is a considerable walk back at the moment about making any admissions publicly. So I do think that the Congress in private session is going to hear from whistleblowers. I don't think there's much doubt about that, because what we do know is that the National Defense Authorization Act will probably be passed for 2023 by the end of December. And if that happens, and if the UAP whistleblower provisions survive the scrutiny of both the House and the Congress, then you will have provisions in place to protect people who I know are wanting to come forward. And Chris Mellon has said the same thing, and so has Gary Nolan, who said that he's actually spoken. He told me that he'd actually spoken to whistleblowers. And I've spoken to people who've been approached by individuals in various parts of government, asking them whether they would be willing to testify. So I do think there is a move on for testimony to happen. The big question is, will this leak? And I think it will.
I think let's split this one more time. The sizzle part of it will probably go most effectively to behind closed door hearings in Congress, and we'll feel like it's a fizzle because we will not get the public hearing that we want, where some of those same people come forward. I hope that's not the case. I hope there are authentic public hearings. But I'll tell you one thing. You mentioned it, the National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed last year. It's passed every year. And by the way, it has passed 61 years in a row, because this is sort of the holy grail. You don't let national defense fall by the wayside. So it's expected that it will pass in December. Remember last year's, which was sort of the Rubio, Gillibrand, and Gallegos amendment, really had some tough language in it. It demanded that yearly unclassified report that is due this year by October 31st. Well, this language this year is tougher in many, many respects. It's reorganizing things. It's demanding people look into the history of this from the intelligence point of view. It's trying to address people that have a problem with a non-disclosure statement that they've had to sign. So I think we're in for a time when at least there are some people in Congress who, if they don't get their way, are going to be pretty damn pissed about it. And so I think things are happening. And also, again, as we've talked about several times on this show, we're coming up on October 31st of this month. And that is the last possible moment this year's public report is supposed to be filed. Remember, the last public report was on June 25th of 2021, and it kind of knocked some people aside and said, they're real. We don't make them, and China and Russia probably don't make them. So what the follow-up report will be, I don't know, but hold on, it's coming, and it's coming 8 days before a midterm election.
Yeah, we can but hope. And as you've, I think, previously noted, whatever happens in the elections, we're going to get a pro-UAP senator. True?
Yeah. Well, in Florida, we certainly are. You know, with all the terrible news coming out of Florida about their weather and everything, there's still a very bitter campaign going on in Florida for the Senate seat that is currently held by Marco Rubio, and he's being challenged by Democrat Val Demings. Now, what's interesting about that is that Rubio, as we all know, has been very outspoken on the UAP issue. Go figure. But he's been the one who, with Gillibrand, reached across the aisle. They had a bipartisan meeting of the minds on last year's NDAA, and he's been very open in discussing his concerns about UAP and national security in various interviews. Well, Val Demings is a former prosecutor. She was on one of the intelligence committees, and her statements after the May 17th public hearing that was held in Congress were very strong. She basically said, look, as a prosecutor, I'm all about protecting people. I'm about safety for constituents. And certainly that is how I'm going to approach the UAP issue. We want to know answers, since there's obviously an increasing amount of these reports, and we want to know where they're coming from and what, and if they're a threat to us. So I think either way, Florida is going to get a senator that's going to be big on this topic.
Now, while we're talking about what might happen in Congress and the potential for public hearings, one of the witnesses, of course, whom we've all speculated we'd love to see put under oath and deposed is Admiral Tom Wilson. And there's been a significant development in the Wilson notes. For the listeners and viewers who aren't familiar with this, there is a story about a leaked or a document that came from the estate of Edgar Mitchell after Edgar Mitchell died, called the Wilson Memo or the Wilson Notes. And it's a series of notes which purportedly represent a conversation between a Department of Defense astrophysicist called Eric Davis, Dr. Eric Davis, and a former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a man called Admiral Thomas Tom Wilson. And the leaked transcript of their conversation basically details how Tom Wilson allegedly discovered and was subsequently denied full access to a incredible conspiracy, a kind of a black budget reverse engineering program hidden deep within the national security state that claims, these documents claim, that the Pentagon or someone in the intelligence community, or more likely a private aerospace company that's been gifted this material, has in its possession an intact craft, a vehicle of non-human origin. Now, I'm telling you all this in the preamble because it's important that in those notes, there is mention of a man called Oak Shannon. And Oak is a former US Navy veteran, physicist. He used to work at the Los Alamos National Laboratories. And he's a key part of these allegedly leaked notes, which record this conversation between Tom Wilson and Eric Davis. Because Tom Wilson, to my friend and colleague Billy Cox, and also to me, specifically denied knowing Oak Shannon. Right. He said he was unknown to Tom Wilson. And in an interview with Jay Anderson of Project Unity, Oak Shannon has basically put it definitively on the record that he does know Admiral Wilson. Moreover, he's confirmed on the record that the claims made in the notes about a conversation he had with Tom Wilson to set up the meeting with Eric Davis and to find out about Eric Davis and whether or not he was a good human being to talk to, this happened. And Eric Davis allegedly, in the notes, they went on and discussed these things. And what's really important is Oak says that he really did discuss with Tom Wilson the reality that a recovered non-human vehicle is being studied in extreme secrecy by this secretive group, the program, somewhere inside government or somewhere inside aerospace. Now, that's a long and involved explanation and probably not told very well, but it's significant because Oak Shannon has gone on the record, and he's a very important cog to giving the Wilson memo notes credibility. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. I still don't accept that the notes are a definitive, true, and accurate record because, of course, they are strenuously denied by Admiral Tom Wilson. And conspicuously, Dr. Eric Davis has never corroborated or confirmed the notes, but neither has he denied the notes are a genuine document. So we're getting closer, I think, to a moment in Congress where people will be able to be deposed, and that's when it's going to start getting interesting. It would be great to see whether Oak Shannon is prepared to testify and whether Eric Davis and Tom Wilson are willing to testify and say what they know.
I listen, it's a story that we need to be covering. I kind of volunteer us to, in a future episode, do the whole episode about it. And frankly, maybe we should do a dramatic interp and read those notes word for word, because I think sure. That would be interesting. Just a quick addition to that. During the May 17th public hearings in the House of Representatives, Representative Mike Gallagher out of Wisconsin actually had the Wilson-Davis memo put into the congressional record. That doesn't mean anything per se, because you can put anything in the congressional record, but he put it in. And let's face it, what you suggested happening, Ross, would be if Congress had any balls about this thing, they'd drag the whole lot of them in and they would put them under oath, and then they would ask them to tell the story, and they would cross-reference it, and we get some answers.
Now, speaking of answers, just last month, or in fact, in the last few weeks, there's been revelations from Ukraine, from Ukrainian astronomers who claim they've seen anomalous objects in the sky. Now, I know there's been rebuttal and debunking of that, notably by Avi Loeb and also by the Academy of Sciences in Ukraine. But coming up in the next segment, we have an interview with a former British soldier, John Chapman, who's going to tell us how he and his team, reconnaissance team, behind the lines in Russian held territory in Ukraine, looked up during a battle and saw a UAP. That's coming up next on Need to Know. So welcome back to Need to Know. Now, we've got something very interesting for you. As I mentioned in the first segment, there has been some controversy about claims made by Ukrainian astronomers in the past few weeks that they've seen anomalous objects in the skies over Ukraine. Not surprising, perhaps, in light of the fact that there's any number of aeroplanes, drones, weaponry flying in and around the skies. But I'm going to introduce you now to a chap called John Chapman. He's a former British Army soldier. G'day, John. How are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. How are you in Australia?
Very well. And I'll put you on to Bryce as well from Los
Angeles.
John,
we appreciate you coming on. This is an important story. And frankly, it couldn't be more timely.
Can you please give us an account of who you are and your service history, of what you feel comfortable telling us, and give us an idea of how and when you got to Ukraine?
I was in the Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment as a reconnaissance soldier. So that's what I specialised in. Shapes of vehicles, aeroplanes, you name it. That was our job to report on, to send up the chain to our command structure to know what we was dealing against. So that's sort of my main role. And I got out and become a close protection officer, bodyguard, as you might call it. And then from there, I sort of gave up that sort of job to become a bit more normal and become a builder. But I also, when I went down that route, I kept my eyes on geopolitics and stuff like that, and obviously the annexation of Crimea in Ukraine, and I thought it was going to end badly. And then obviously the build up on the border in February, and then they invaded, and from there I looked at what was going on. And the catalyst for me going to the Ukraine was there was a, I think it was a BMP, run over a car. And I think it was in Kharkiv, I believe. And I thought, I can't have that. I can't sit here and watch bearing in mind I've been to Bosnia and places like that, and I know what ethnic cleansing and how that can be. And I thought, I've got to do something. And I asked my wife, and she wasn't happy for me to go, obviously. And she said to me, you've been there for about 2 weeks, because I, well, a week, in fact, because I said on a Monday and I was gone by the Saturday. So she gave me a sort of blessing, as it were, with gritted teeth. And I went across. I went through Poland and then across the border, which was all arranged through the Ukrainian embassy in London. So the network to get across was all arranged. And we went to a sort of a transit camp, Yarev. And that's where we sort of, all the people arriving from foreign nationals.
John, I want to just clarify this, because I think some people probably having the same question I'm having. Were you part of any official group at that time? Were you part of any nation's military, or were you?
No. We was all ex-military. However, okay, there was a few, how we say, Walter Mitties, who say they was in things like paintballers and airsofters and all these type of people trying to get in, but they were soon weeded out.
You got in, though, with other people, or did you go in by yourself and then?
I went on my own.
Okay.
And because of the migration of people coming from all over the world, obviously there's only so many airheads in Poland, and obviously the groups were meeting at airports, and then I didn't know any person there. I went on my own, and then because we met at airports, going through the same route through the embassies, the transport was arranged, and you just got on a bus, you didn't know anybody, and then you was taken to this camp, and then you build friendships on the bus or meet people, but I didn't know anyone to go with. And then we went to, like I said, went to Yarev, and from there we was sort of divided in our previous military experience and perhaps people who didn't have any. So the people who didn't have any, they were also going to join the Legion, but they went into sort of a training, sort of 6 weeks of training, so I never saw any of them again.
John, can I just interrupt for a moment, just for the benefit of our listeners and viewers? I just want to state, yeah, John has provided me with documentation on background, which we'll not be revealing, which more than substantiates the fact of his British service history, which is exemplary, and also the fact that he worked with the Ukrainian army to serve in Ukraine. Now, one of the things that I want to get to, John, is your role. You were part of a team called Bravo Team, working, I think, with a former Republic of Korea Special Forces guy, and you were behind the lines at different times doing reconnaissance and targeting Russian enemy inside that area. Really gutsy stuff. Just before we get to the detail of your UAP sighting, which I understand happened in April, just give us an account of, we're talking to the video that you've already sent me that we'll probably cut into the story at this stage. But give us a description of the kind of work you were doing. There's a video where you're clearly behind the lines, and in one case, the Russians are literally just outside. How close were you?
Well, basically, a concrete wall. We was on that video clip. We were sent out to basically find the Russians and get some information on where they're at and what strengths they are. So we moved through a chosen route to a certain building that we thought, which we deemed would give us a good line of sight for the missile systems we had, and also for our small arms. And on doing that, we got into the building, and this is sort of a walk-in reconnaissance. We hadn't seen the building, only on a map. So it was quite, you know, normally we like to recce everything to make sure it's safe before you use it. But it was, it was a sort of something we wouldn't normally do. Anyway, we entered the building, we cleared the building, and then we found at one side there was a massive hole that a tank had put a hole in a wall, and we thought that would be a good position to shoot from our in-laws. And then as one of our operators spotted a BMP with some infantry, he was going to fire that projectile, but they were spotted. And unfortunately, one of our operators, Otto, was shot in the shoulder, and we had to clear that building. But
so you're behind enemy lines. You've got a wounded operator. I mean, this is pretty hairy stuff. And you're a foreign national. I mean, you would have been under no illusions about what would have happened to you if the Russians had actually found you.
Well, I had to keep one for myself, Ross. But it's hairy stuff. And I can honestly say the adrenaline is going through your body and it keeps you going. And they followed us back basically to the Ukrainian line. So we was getting chased by a BMP, which you can hear firing on the video. You can also hear small arms firing at us all the time. We've got Otto to get back. And so we had to fire maneuver back. And then when we got back to the relatively safely of this Ukrainian lines, which was really just a block of flaps, we had to deal with artillery as well coming in on us. So it was a bit of a hairy day.
Now, I only cite that video because it's a very good example of what you guys were going through. Now,
are you able to share that video right now, Ross?
Yeah, I can. I think we should share that.
And while he's doing that, John, let me just ask you a question. You're part of the Bravo team. What is that? I think people are probably saying, well, how many people are on it? What different nationalities? Where did you catch your mission? Just how did it, so that we can understand when you tell us the rest of the story, what's going on there?
Well, the beginning of the war, everything was catching up. And it was all sort of all hands to the pump, bearing in mind, because of what Kiev was, the Russians obviously come down from Belarus. And I think what they were thinking of, we cut off the head of Kiev, everything else will tumble. So that was their sort of plan. And it was like the little guy in the Dutch dyke, all fingers to the holes. And we was just basically, I got there. I think it was on the Saturday in Kiev, and on the Sunday I was on the front line. It was that quick. The situation on the ground was so fluid that we was just thrust into anywhere. And as your other question, what sort of nationalities you were, we had French Foreign Legion lads, ex-lads. One of them was Finnish. One of them was actually Ukrainian. We had Americans. We had obviously British. We had Koreans, and we had a lot of experience in our groups of seen conflicts all over the world, and we was more than capable to deal with the threat of the Russians.
So on the night in question that we're about to get into, how many people were part of Bravo team?
Bravo team was 8 guys at the time.
Okay.
However, there was another team that was at part of the Legion who we didn't have any association with, because we work for the Ukrainian intelligence. They just happened to be on the ground at the crossing point, the footbridge we wanted to cross outside Irpin. So they would have seen it as well, but I have no contact with any of those guys. I knew none of them. Again, they were just, another Legion sort of outfit.
What I understand happened was that there's a crossing point in Kyiv, across the river from the Russian side.
In Irpin.
Irpin. And where Irpin, is it? Yeah. It's on the suburbs outside.
Yeah, Irpin's on the western suburbs of Kiev. So it's like a little city on its own. And it's got a river on the eastern edge of Irpin, which we had to cross, which we'll come on to in a minute. Now, there was 3 crossing points. There was a bridge, which is blown, as in a flyover for cars and trucks and so forth, a railway bridge, which is gone, and a footbridge, which hasn't. So the first op we went on, which I sent you a video as well, we, on our way back from our first op, there was a little garden centre by a roundabout. Well, I think it was a garden centre, that sort of place. It was night anyway. And we was using that as a holding area, waiting for our turn to cross the bridge, which was blown. And basically, we'd go underneath the bridge, there was planks put across the river, and we'd cross it. But unknown to us, we was followed by a drone. Now, we couldn't see, hear this drone, total pitch black, and we're sort of sitting in this sort of garden centre. I'd pulled up a plastic chair, and I'm sat on this plastic chair, and I'm eating a wafer, you know, a few lads getting a few drink of water, having a fag, because they've not been able to for the last, you know, 5 or 6 hours. And we're sat there, and these rounds start coming in, and there's a sort of a little copse adjacent to this building complex we're in. And these rounds are going off, and I'm eating my wafer going, this is nice. Oh, that's a bit close. And, it's even closer. And finally, they're right on top of us. And one of our friends, ex-Navy SEAL, he gets hit in the arse by a bit of concrete, which is quite amusing. He dropped his phone as well, which he... But anyway, that's another story. And we're thinking, we need to get out of here. But, it's quite a funny video to watch. And so also that
video shows where you were crossing the night of the UAP sighting a few days later.
A few days before, that's why I see the UAP, because I was worried about the sky with drones following us to the footbridge.
Right.
If that makes sense. So I was, yeah.
So roll forward now. So basically we've described the location. It's obviously a very hot zone.
Yeah.
When you go through there, you are worried because of the previous day's engagement. You're worried about being mortared and targeted with drones and artillery.
That's correct.
And so a few days later, you basically come to that same position. It's nighttime, and you're coming back from the Russian lines, back across the bridge into Erbil. What happens?
Well, just going to correct you on slightly, Ross. We crossed about a mile further up the river on the footbridge, and we got back to that sort of the Erping side of the river, and we're waiting there for our time to cross. And I'm looking at the sky, and we're all sort of an all-round defence waiting to cross. And all of a sudden, because I was looking at the sky, I see three dimly lit orange amber orbs, or burnt amber, as I'd say, they're like a brownie orange colour. But there was only, because I had to sort of rub my eyes, I thought, am I seeing things? Because I thought I was tired. And I looked up, and I did see these three orbs in a loose triangle shape. And they was there for 3 or 4 seconds. And the next thing, there was a bright light that appeared in the sky. And it was about, I would say, 1,000 foot up, and probably between 30 and 40 feet long. And it was a bright light like a camera flash, but constant. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, what the hell is that? It's not a drone. It's not a plane. It's not a flare. It's not nothing associated with a battlefield. And the way it flew across the sky, it maintained its altitude. It maintained its speed, but its speed was only about, I'd say, airspeed about 30 knots. So it's quite slow, but there was no sound. There was no characteristics of a plane.
Did it hold a hover? Did it hold a hover at any stage?
No, it didn't. I have done aerial photography from a helicopter, and you fly at a certain height, a certain speed, so you maintain, so you can get a good view for your camera when you're filming. And it looked like it was doing some sort of reconnaissance. It looked like it was following the river. And it was basically the other side of the river we were going to, the home bank, as it were, the Kiev side. There was a defensive line of Ukrainian positions that followed that river all the way across, just in case the Russians took Erpin. The next sort of stop line would have been that line of defenses. And it was absolutely incredible. I had to pinch myself, and other people see it as well. And Yeah, and nobody reacted to it. We didn't fire at it or anything like that. We're just in awe going, what is that?
Let me just make sure that I've got this in my head. So
yeah,
you're out there and you're looking up and you're seeing these three lights originally. I don't know if these three lights are moving or do they move into a position?
No, I just happened to be looking at a portion of the sky because I was worried about drones and getting mortared from what happened to the previous days. And as I was looking at a portion of the sky, three, let's say, orbs come into view from nothing. So just weren't there. And then from there, they was there for about 3 or 4 seconds. They disappeared, and simultaneously, this craft just appeared. Just bright light appeared,
why do you say craft, John? Like, give us an idea of the form that you saw. You initially described a very bright light. Why do you say craft?
Yeah,
because the only thing what I know what creates that bright light in the sky is a flare. Now, if I know the characteristics of a flare, or we'd call them a shimuli or parallel, or whatever you want to call them. Now, it wasn't any of those. And you go through, well, my sort of military thinking, you go through a process. What is that? Is it this? Is it that? And the reason I say craft, because it's maintained an altitude. It's flew at a constant speed. And go on.
Did you see structure to it, though? I mean, when you say craft,
I'll just elaborate on that. The way the light pattern was, obviously, when you see any light, you can see if it's a headlight of a car, you can see it's round, can't you? But you can't actually see the car. So what I was looking at almost looked, not almost, it did. It did look a long oval shape. So higher in the middle and then tapered off at the ends.
Like a disc?
Possibly. I was thinking about it sort of today, I think it's a Calvern sighting, that sort of diamond shape maybe. I don't know. But the lights, if you can imagine that shape, but mega bright lights coming from it, it would create a sort of that sort of shape, wouldn't it? So I'm only surmising, but
so for, was the light from within the object or was it around the object?
It was the object. You know, it was just so bright in the sky. I cannot say how bright it was. I can't put it into words. It was so bright.
Okay, so let me just again. So we've got these three things making what amounts to a triangle. Would you?
A loose triangle, yeah.
It looks like a triangle. And at the same time, they disappear. And at that same instant as they're disappearing, this craft or bright object appears.
To me, and I'm, you know, what do I know? It looked like a door. It was coming through a door. So it opened with the orbs. And then next minute, you've got a craft there or the bright light.
Now, that's interesting because if you go through UFO literature, there have been cases where people have described what the only word they could come up with was there was a door in the sky and something came through it. So when you use the word door, are you talking in a literal sense that it looked like a door, or are you saying it felt like a doorway?
I can't put my finger on a description of it. All I can say is when the orbs went out, the bright light come on and it looked like what, do you know what I mean? Because it was so instantaneous, the lights went out on the orbs and then this bright light was moving across the sky.
Do you think this object, you clearly seem to, do you think this object was intelligently controlled?
Yeah, because things, like you take anything what flies in the sky, if it flies at a rate of knots, stays at the same height, you know, that to me is intelligent, you know?
So it wasn't a balloon, an illuminated balloon or a barrage balloon or something like that?
No. And not only that, you're over a battlefield and you don't show your hand. You don't go, oh, look at me in the sky, come and shoot me. And not, and the other thing that I've sort of mulled about, because of air defense systems, you don't fly 1,000 feet up at 30 knots because you won't be there for much longer.
And so why didn't somebody shoot at it? I mean, either on the Russian side or on your side?
Because my jaw was on the floor. I didn't know what it was. Because your brain, your military brain, I was going through, right, is it a drone? No. You don't see drones in Russia until it's too late. In Ukraine. Is it a plane? No, there's no noise. It's moving too slow. There's no, you know, flight characteristics. There's no sort of trail behind it for, you know, afterburners or anything like that.
No noise?
No noise at all. No. Quiet, silent.
Well, I just want to clarify one other thing, Ben. You said that the Bravo team had 8 people on, including yourself.
Yeah.
Were all 8 of you in this location at the same time, and did the other 7 see what you saw?
They see it. The only thing I'm not sure about, if they saw the orbs, because the orbs were very, very there 1 minute and gone, you know, a couple of seconds later. And I believe I'm the only one who see the orbs because I was looking in that portion of the sky at that time. I've not questioned everybody, but I have, when we come back in off the op, I spoke to the people I was bunking with, and we was like, ah, that's a UAP. That was an American lad, and I think it was an Australian lad. It was an Australian lad, and we just didn't know what it was.
John, Ross had mentioned it. Avi Loeb had written an article recently about the various things that the Ukrainian report was saying were unidentified flying objects, they were saying. I think they called them phantoms, and what was the other thing? I don't remember. But so they, and Loeb's analysis was, well, the last place I'd ever want to study UFOs is in a battlefield condition like in Ukraine, because they got all manner of shit flying around there. How would you know what's what? But you are a trained reconnaissance person, so I assume that you know pretty much the outline of most things that we find in the sky. And I'd like a description of your training to identify things in the sky so that we can appreciate how you are saying this one stands out as not being something that's supposed to be there.
Shape is the main thing, because it was quite close. You know, it was 1,000 feet up, probably less than half a mile away. So is it a threat is going through my head. Everyone else has said, because you don't know, do I need to take cover? Is that an incoming missile, that bright light? Is it, you know, a multitude of things?
Do you think it was interested in the battlefield?
Yes, I do. I rationalize everything. And just that's what I would do. If I was taking pictures or interested in something on the ground from a helicopter, that's what I would do. You know, perhaps not on a battlefield like that, but perhaps on a covert reconnaissance mission in Northern Ireland or something like that. If you want to get pictures of a target, that's how you would do it. I could honestly say it was anything that I've ever seen.
From the moment that you saw the orbs, which you said lasted not long, and then suddenly you've got this other thing there, what amount of time are we talking about?
I reckon, because of the speed and the terrain, obviously it disappeared from our view. It didn't go out, it just disappeared because of the terrain. But I would suggest probably anything between 3 to 5 minutes.
So wow. You had eyes on it for a while.
Yeah, so it just went away. And it was like a, you know, as it disappeared, it looked like a star or a planet, because it was that far away.
Obvious question, John. I mean, you've obviously taken videos while you were behind the lines filming next to the Russians. How come there's no video or photography of what you saw if you were watching it for 5 minutes?
Because we're worried about getting shelled and being killed was more important than the UFO at the time, in the sky at the time. Obviously, you have to remember the situation we were in. We wasn't in, you know, we wasn't in a park in London somewhere looking up at the sky, stargazing. We was worried about, we had more important things like you know, our own safety and protection. So we're all in out, all around the fence. We're looking out for Russians. That just happened to be, turn up. That wasn't our sort of main point of concern at the time.
That makes completely good sense. But my question would be, after this was over and you guys got back to where you came from, and now you're not going to be shot or killed, hopefully, in that scenario, you must have had a time where the group of you said, "Holy crap, did you see that thing?" What was that conversation like?
And we just don't know what it was. It was just like, because of the speed of the ops we was on, we didn't have time really to, you know, like sit down and we're having a chat now about it and I'm talking about it. It was an afterthought. It wasn't important at the time. It's been like a splinter on my brain ever since I saw it.
John, I know from your service history, which you very kindly shared with me, that you've seen in combat zones and in different parts of different military installations, you've seen a lot of military equipment. You're very, very well briefed as a reconnaissance surveillance person on what the West and indeed our potential enemies have. Is there any technology that you can think of that can explain what you saw?
No, honestly, Ross, there isn't. And, you know, I know that on this phenomena, people say, was it, you know, military black technology or something like that. But what would be the purpose of that at that particular time over that area showing itself to maybe the Russians as well as the Ukrainians? What would be the mission of that particular craft if it was a black craft?
Now, just so I'm clear, one other thing that I think that you've given me in a map, it clearly tracks the river, which is the dividing line between the Russians in the, I think, the south or the east, and the Kiev in the north. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there was people in Irpin from the Ukrainians, but that line was the next defensive line if the Russians took Irpin. So that river would have been an obstacle for the Russians to get across. That's why the bridges have gone. So that would have been, so that UAP flew far in the river with basically the Russians on the eastern side and the Ukrainians on the western side.
This is a key moment in the battle for Kyiv, isn't it? This is one of the days where it's a deciding point for whether or not the Russians are going to take Kyiv.
If Irpin would have fell, the next step was Kyiv.
So this is a very strategically important moment in the battle to help save Ukraine.
Yes, it was, yeah.
John, you've done a pretty good job of maintaining your professional distance and telling us what you know and saying what you don't know about the whole sighting. My question is, clearly, if this happened in April, there's been a number of months where you've been living with this moment. And I'm wondering, in your quiet moments inside your own head, as you try to make sense of it, what do you think was going on? And again, I know that part, you've laid out what happened very clearly and journalistically. Now I'm asking you to just tell us what your thought process was. What do you think you saw and why was it there?
I wish I knew. My thought process, as I've already mentioned, it definitely wasn't military. It definitely wasn't a military item of equipment that I'd ever seen, ever.
Do you think it was a solid object, John?
I'm not going to guess. All I can say is, like I said earlier, the shape of it appeared to be, you know, a long oval with tapered ends, you know, and it's a very bright light. And that's all I can say.
You certainly know your share of things that are flying around in the sky. And I think your case demonstrates something that people have talked about for years. So I just want to get your thoughts on this. Clearly, anything of the capacity to do some of the things that UAP have been described as doing could figure out how not to shine bright lights in the night sky, right?
Yeah.
And yet they do quite often in terms of their descriptions. Why would somebody shine bright lights in a war zone?
They wouldn't, and that's the thing. It's not, you know, unless it's a, you know, a very a deception plan for something, but nothing happened. It just, a bright light appeared from, like I said, the free orbs and flew across the sky at a set altitude, a set speed, and went out of sight. There was no reason that I can possibly think of why it was in that battle space.
And did you report this to any of the command structure upstairs?
No. No. And that was...
Why not?
One is because we were foreigners, and I didn't want to go to Ukraine and, you know, and say, look, I've just seen this bright light in the sky. They'd be like, what have you been smoking, dude? Off you go, first plane back. I've sat at home since I've been back, and I've been reflecting, quite rightly, as you mentioned, Bryce, what I see. And it just got to the point, you know, about a week ago, whenever it was, I just had to, you know, just get it off my chest. It's been a mad experience for me. You know, I'm coming on this program. I love your program, guys. I've seen it before and everything else. But it's my reputation as well that I'm hanging out there. Yeah, I'm gonna get some flack for it, I'm sure, from mates.
Well, let's talk about that, important. John. I mean, the bottom line is, the problem is that there is this stigma. I mean, Bryce and I interviewed Ryan Graves, the former fighter pilot, a few weeks ago. And Ryan talked about that same stigma. But really, ultimately, what you're talking about is a potential national security issue. I mean, you're there on a battlefield. You're literally in a position where days earlier you've come under artillery and mortar fire. For good reason. You're very, very worried about being detected. The Russians are trying to kill you. And then all of a sudden, there's this weird, highly illuminated object hovering 1,000 feet above you. By any definition, that's a military concern, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I don't know what the Ukrainians have on their radar, which they would have had around Kiev. Was that UAP picked up? I have no idea. And that might be something to look into from your end.
John, personal question, just because I'm always intrigued. There's always a personal part of this. What does your wife think about all this? What conversations have you had? When did you tell her? What does she think? What does she think about you being public? You know, talk to us.
She doesn't know yet.
Okay. All right. Okay. We broke some news here. We may not have broken news to the world, but we broke it to his wife. That's good. Yeah. All right.
So, no, she doesn't know yet, but I'm sure she will soon.
Well, what did she say? You've told her, though, about it, haven't you?
No, not yet. No. This is it. Okay. So this will be it.
Prior to this event happening to you, John, what was your thought about the UFO UAP issue?
I've always believed that we're not alone. Only because if you I can't remember what the equation is now, but if you do the maths of the size of the universe, you know, just that simple equation, we're not alone. I've always looked up at the sky, you know, I've seen satellites and stuff like that. Been, oh, is that something? But no, it's always been a satellite. And this sighting was totally, totally different.
And so, John, tell me this. So the one thing I'm very happy to hear, you were listening and watching Need to Know episodes in Ukraine, weren't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, obviously, in the time we had, you know, between ops, we had one of the Elon Musk Sky Link thingies, so we could get internet. So that, yeah, I'm just interested in something like Lou and Jeremy. You know, I've always listened to what they want to say, and it's very interesting. It's very interesting. The work you guys do behind the scenes, because it's not just, you know, the sightings, it's also the mountain of paperwork, the government being a pack, well, all governments being a pain up the backside to release stuff and trying to link. It's like having a jigsaw puzzle and you nearly completed it, but your little brother's hid 5 of the pieces all over the house and you're trying to find them to finish a puzzle. But I think we're close to finishing that puzzle, but it's going to take a lot of work to do.
John, when we started the show and you were able to listen to what we were talking about, you know, we were talking about the idea that the energy behind Congress seems to be national security, that they're talking about, we need to know this, not because we're all that interested in are we alone, but we're interested in are we safe, right? So people have different responses when they see something anomalous. Some people are in awe. Some people are afraid. Some people don't see it at all, while other people may be looking at the same thing and seeing it. What was your overriding sense? Do you feel we have something to be concerned about? Do you feel that there is a threat behind the kind of thing that you saw?
At that time, I didn't feel, bearing in mind I was in a war zone for that sighting, I didn't feel threatened at all. I was just in awe of it, to be honest. But in general, I suppose the only sort of safety issue, if you've got uncontrolled things flying around in the sky, you know, you've got aircraft, helicopters, you know, you've got weather balloons, you've got drones, something sometimes going to get hit and fall out of the sky. So that's the only sort of threat I see, well, I can perceive with anomalies in the sky.
Well, I, for one, John, applaud. I'm sure Bryce does as well. I think it's commendable that you've approached it and come forward. And I think what you've described of what you saw on a battlefield in Ukraine, on the outskirts of Kyiv, a peak moment in the war, a decisive moment in the battle to save Kyiv from Russian invasion, I think it's very significant. And just maybe there was some non-human intelligence taking an interest in what is probably going to be remembered as a very important moment in history. And I want to thank you very, very much for sharing your account with us.
People in your position often get thanked for their service. I want to thank you for your observation. I want to thank you for coming forward with it. And I hope that the lesson that this very show makes and that your appearance makes is that we're going to need more of this, not less. We need more people speaking in the public forum and not behind closed doors and not for reports that never get seen by the public. So what you've done, I'm just going to speak up for you to your wife.
Oh, thanks.
I'm glad that John did this. He's a true hero to come forward like this. And I hope you take her out to dinner and give her the bottom line.
I can John, hear a rap in the tinfoil hat now.
Well, John, we can all be accused of that. But listen, I also do want to thank you for your service. I mean, we all watch on with horror at what's unfolding in Ukraine, and we feel powerless. And it's wonderful that a person with your skill set was able to go over there and have the courage to go and do what you did, which was incredibly brave behind the lines. And I do know I'm in touch with other members of your team who hopefully in future episodes of Need to Know will be able to corroborate what you saw. And really just want to say thank you. Thank you very, very much for joining us. And I think we actually have to bring it to an end, Bryce, that even though this has been a very compelling episode, we're coming to an end of this episode of Need to Know. But I can assure you we will be covering this issue. We will be approaching the Ukrainian government and asking them if they had radar. We'll try and get some more details on exactly when this incident occurred. Bryce and I will probably put an article up on the Trail of the Sources Medium page that we operate that gives more detail of this account. And I think that brings this episode of Need to Know to an end. And thank you very much to you, John Chapman. And
you're welcome.
We'll be back again with another ep of Need to Know very soon.